Good afternoon. My name is Ann Cabal, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board and Volunteers, I welcome you to the BCEA webinar education series. I encourage you to grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. Today we have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Also, for those connected via webcast, you should see a box to the left of the slides where you can submit questions during this session. 2019, again, is a year that the BCA continues to expand our mission of providing breast cancer educational resources. This year's educational programming continues to encourage, engage, and empower those affected by breast cancer in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year, participation and support of culturally appropriate cancer screening education and outreach programs to reduce disparities in the burden of cancer. We are very excited to report that three mini conferences are already being planned, with the first happening in just a couple of weeks. Another opportunity is our Signature Education Conference, which is scheduled for October 5th at the Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. This conference will deliver the most up-to-date information on breast cancer diagnosis and treatments, will feature a mobile mammography unit, and many roundtable discussions that connect attendees on the most pressing breast health topics. The conference will feature Dr. Keith Knutson updating us on the newest developments on a breast cancer vaccine. Please mark your calendar for October 5th, and we hope to see you there. We also offer increased ongoing resources on our website and social media channels, which are available 24/7. If you were unable to attend any of our previous webinars, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCA website at breastcancereducation.org. Under the webinar tab. This is a great way to easily access valuable information at your convenience. We also invite you to join us for a little fun and participate in our upcoming partner fundraiser. It's the Community for All Brewery Crawl on March 30th, beginning at Birch's Lower Town in St. Paul. Again, visit our social media channels or our website for complete details. We also welcome your involvement in our organization. We welcome participation on all levels and have many different types of volunteer opportunities available, whether it's just for an hour a year or a couple hours a month. We have exciting plans for this year, as we just discussed, and we hope that you can help us deliver education and empowerment to those fighting breast cancer. Please also keep your eye out for more information on upcoming webinars, including our next session on breast radiology with Dr. Tricia Prescott on May 29th. We will share specific information on all sessions as soon as complete details are available. And now I'd like to introduce the speaker for today's webinar. It's Barb Kuntz. Barb Kuntz is a licensed certified genetic counselor with over 30 years of experience in a wide range of hospital and clinic settings. She has been a cancer genetic counselor for the last 20 years as senior genetic counselor at North Memorial Cancer Center, and now as a genetic counselor through the McKesson Specialty Health, supporting the U.S. Oncology Network cancer genetic providers. Welcome, Barb.
Thanks so much for having me talk today. I'm looking forward to getting questions from the audience and happy to share what I can.
Great.
Thanks. Should I start?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, it seems like we can't go anywhere these days without the popularity of genetics showing itself in ads that show up or products that are on the market. And some of them have a lot of link with genetics and some don't really. And we all help fund this knowledge by funding the Human Genome Project that figured out how many genes we have and is still giving us information about what genetics plays as a part in disease, including cancer. The big change has been, because of that funding and the technology from it, that we now have genetic testing costs that have plummeted in the last 10 years. And really, instead of being thousands of dollars, they're hundreds of dollars. And we also know more about what genes do, and the tests can tell us more. But this technology is outpacing right now what we know about genes. So people can get tested for genes, but there's still some catch-up that needs to be done on understanding what genes do. And so sometimes we're in this weird situation where people get tested for genes and know they have a change in them, but we don't know very much about them. And we will see a lot more knowledge coming online in the next decade about some of these things that we don't know as much about. So it's an exciting time to be in genetics, and we can see that from all this genetic information, all these products are coming on the market, from the things on the left that are tests that are available for people to just order themselves and learn things like Venome is how your genes influence what kind of wine you like, to Ancestry, to some of them are really starting to, and some traits like, let's say, do I like the taste of cilantro is one of the traits on 23andMe, to they're starting to delve into the more aspects of health, and some of them are actually starting to cross over to some of the clinical tests that we have. As a genetic counselor, it's very exciting to see how we have all these tools that really give answers that I never could give to people 30 years ago. And the information can be used to actually change people's care and give people information that can help them be proactive in either getting different screening, knowing about their cancer risks that they have or have not inherited, and using strategies to improve their health. The ones on the bottom, the handful of companies I have at the bottom, are really some of the key companies that now provide clinical quality genetic testing that, for cancer, and they do other genes as well. So that's what I mostly overlap with. So I like to always step back and say, keep in mind that cancers have a lot of different causes, and most cancers are not hereditary. They think maybe about 10%, maybe as high as 15% of cancers overall are due primarily to a gene that's coming down through a family that gets passed to some people and not to others and gives an increased risk. Environmental causes can cause cancer, and a lot of cancer is more complex why it happens. It's a combination of genes with a small effect combining with environment. When we're talking about how cancer develops on a genetic level, keep in mind that we have our background DNA that we inherited at conception from our mom and our dad. We have 20,000 genes, and every gene comes in pairs, and I got one from my mom and one from my dad. We call that the germline DNA because it comes in the egg and the sperm, which are germ cells. And they're in every cell of our body, and that's our background DNA that we inherited. And what happens with cancer is some group of cells will start acquiring changes beyond what was there in the DNA. And there are changes in the instructions of our cells in the DNA. And enough of those changes accumulate so those cells act differently. And so if we look at the DNA in a tumor, the genetic background in a tumor, it will have added changes on top of that background DNA. Now, so the reason I mention that is all cancers happen because of genetic changes that happen to cells, often over time, and aren't inherited, but some have an inherited piece. So the things we can't control are aging. You know, cancer happens over time. The longer I live, the more chance I have of developing it. And then there are things like smoking. We know that activity can contribute to cancer risk, inactivity. Viruses like HPV are linked with cervical cancer and head and neck cancers, and that's why we now have vaccines for kids when they're young before they get exposed to these. And radiation, like UV radiation from the sun, can cause skin cancer. And high doses of radiation treatment for some cancers can cause increased risk for cancer later for individuals. So what happens when a change happens in a gene? Think of a gene that it makes something.
it's a factory for making a protein. So I'm a gene and I make a healthy protein that can go around the body and do the job that it's supposed to do. If it accumulates a change in it, if it's a minor change, it still might be able to go around and do its job. But if it has a significant change to it, then it can't go do its job. And if it's especially a gene that's job is part of protecting me from getting cancer by fixing mistakes in my cells, then I might be more prone to cancer. So it's not that we have that cancer genes are bad genes. They're actually good genes that when they have an error in them, I'm more prone to get cancer because they can't do the good job that they're supposed to do. So that's a gene mutation. So there isn't, like I said before, the background DNA versus the cancer DNA. Changes that just happen in the cancer, like on the left, are not inherited. They're just changes that happen in that group of cells. When I'm looking as a job as a genetic counselor for inherited cancers, we're talking about a change in a gene that can be passed down at conception, and then if I carry it, I may or may not pass it down to my children. The way that this typically works, and there are a few cancer conditions that are a little different, but most of the time it's that, let's pretend I am the mom in this diagram. So I have two genes, and one of them has a mutation in it. Every time I go to have a child, I either pass on one of the gene or the other. So it's a 50-50 chance I will pass it on or I won't. And if my partner doesn't carry a gene change, then each of my children, every time I have a child, it's a 50-50 chance. And it doesn't matter if I've had a child who has it before, my chance is still 50% chance with every pregnancy. In addition, if I don't pass on that gene mutation, then that child is not at increased risk and their children are not at increased risk. And so on the gene level, the gene mutation either gets passed on or it doesn't. So why should we care about finding families that have an inherited cancer risk? Well, mostly because families that have inherited cancer risk have a much more higher burden of cancer in their families and they need to get different care. Genetic services, including genetic testing, if we find a cause for cancer in the family, we can then use that knowledge to know who has increased risk and who does not have risk. And that can improve medical choices, including now more the choice of different chemotherapies that work better with certain inherited risk. Also, if I have a risk and we can use that to know who to screen, what part of my body to screen, what's the best method of screening? When should we start screening? How often should we screen? And for some families and for some situations, there are choices that people can use to reduce cancer risk by using surgical choices. So I have people who say, well, I don't really need to do genetic testing because I know I have this risk of breast cancer. And that just tells me, like, I already know it runs in my family. But the point is you could find out who has the risk in the family and who does not, and more about the specific risk and if there are other risks of other types of cancers and how best to be followed. I think it's helpful to think about once you find a gene mutation in a family, how many people it can impact. And I'm using a personal picture here. It's a picture of my mom's family. And if you pretend my grandmother had a gene mutation, she's the one who's circled in pink there, she had three daughters. Well, if she had a gene mutation, then we have something called cascade testing that anyone in the family could get tested for whether they carry the gene mutation that's been found in the family and whether they do or do not have it. So in her case, each of her daughters could then get tested and see if they have that gene mutation or not. And the impact, even one generation further to the 13 grandchildren, is a lot of people can find out about their cancer risk that they may or may not have from one person being tested. So that's called cascade testing. It's one of the biggest benefits. It's not only the treatment and knowledge for that person, but sharing that information with relatives and letting them know that information and use it to decide about testing and making medical decisions based on results. So I'm a cancer genetic counselor, and we look for clues of hereditary cancer. And how do we do that? We do something called cancer risk assessment. And what we're essentially doing is looking at people's personal histories. Sometimes that alone can give us signals. Family history of cancer. And we think about what are known hereditary causes of the cancers that are there in a family. Think about genetic testing options, and we can discuss and coordinate appropriate genetic testing. And then if people choose testing, or even if they don't, we can do follow-up with interpreting and discussing test results and what are the kind of surveillance options and cancer prevention options available, and what are the implications for the family. The kinds of things we look for are signs of hereditary cancer, and one of them is an earlier age at diagnosis than you typically see for that cancer. So for breast, uterine, and colon cancer, we're talking about less than age 50. We look for a pattern of cancer coming down through generations. We look just an individual who's had two separate types of cancer, a breast cancer in one breast and then later in another, that might signal an inherited cause. We look for cancers that fit with known hereditary syndromes, meaning a pattern like breast and ovarian is what I'm going to be talking about, and colon and uterine is another one that's linked with something called Lynch syndrome. And in the next slide, I'm going to be talking about specific cancers that we now know all by themselves are indications for testing. Also, the more specifics of the cancer, like for breast cancer, we know that triple negative breast cancers have a higher chance of being hereditary. And just triple negative breast cancer under 60 alone can be an indication for genetic testing. The list of who should be offered genetic services is complex because it's taking into account different ages and the types of cancers in a family. But definitely genetic services should be offered to individuals if there is a known mutation in the family. And if breast cancer has occurred under 50, it's really appropriate to explore what else is going on in the family. Like I said, the triple negative under 60, bilateral, and ovarian cancer alone, male breast cancer alone, metastatic prostate cancer recently got added to the list because prostate cancer is very common, but metastatic prostate cancers have a higher chance of having a hereditary piece to them. So that's kind of a new indication that's been added in the last few years. The other is pancreatic cancer. Now there are enough genes and there's enough reason to look for hereditary cause for pancreatic cancer, and especially the link with BRCA2, and it may impact what kind of treatment people are being offered. We also look at more complex things like three breast cancers in one lineage alone, and we also look at ancestry, and I'm going to be talking about that. So an individual's history or their family history are the combinations we look for. And when we collect family history, people ask me what they need to collect. For cancer, we're mostly looking at where was the primary site, where did a cancer start, and how old was that relative at the time they were diagnosed. And if you can know the exact pathology, that's helpful. And we also look at ethnicity. It's also really important to look at both sides of the family. I don't just care about my mother's side of the family. It's important to look at both sides because an inherited cause for cancer, a mutation in a gene, could come from my mother or my father's side of the family. There's a real limitation with family history for a lot of people. They either don't know their family history, don't know their relatives, or they won't share it, or they're adopted, or sometimes the family structure of the family, it's a really small family, there aren't very many women in it, you won't really see a pattern of cancer unless there are enough relatives at ages that you might be seeing that kind of a pattern. So here's an example of the way we draw family histories, and the bottom line is, the arrow is, a circle is a woman and a square is a man. So this woman has a brother and a sister who are on that line with her, and up above her are her mother and her father, and her mother's side is on the right, and her father's is on the left. So in this case, this woman has a mom who had breast cancer that was diagnosed in 69, and then her father's mother, who's one step up, has had a breast cancer at age 80. This is not a pattern that looks hereditary because the breast cancers are in two separate sides of the family, so So those relatives are not related, and the breast cancers happened at ages that you typically see breast cancers occur. On the other hand, this is a hereditary pattern of a woman who has a sister who had breast cancer at 56 and her father's sister had breast cancer at 60 and the grandmother had breast cancer at 70. Even though no one in the family has had a breast cancer under age 50, it's still a strong enough pattern that even though breast cancer is a fairly common cancer and it's not unusual to see two people in a family with breast cancer, and they may have it for different reasons, it's enough of a pattern that it could be linked with a gene coming down through generations to some people and not others. And as you see, the father in this case hasn't had a cancer. He still could carry the gene but not have gotten a related cancer himself. Here's a family history of a woman who has a sister with ovarian cancer and a paternal grandmother who had breast cancer. And like I said, the ovarian cancer alone is an indication for genetic testing, and the breast cancer may be linked with it, or it could be an age-related breast cancer. I also, this family history points out that even in a family history where it may be a hereditary cause, you will see other cancers in the family that may or may not fit with the pattern and may have happened just for the non-hereditary reasons, like a lung cancer in a maternal aunt. So let's talk a little about BRCA1 and 2. They are the highest risk breast and ovarian cancer genes. We have known about them for several decades, so we have more information than we do about some of the other breast cancer genes. And people who have a mutation in them, you have two copies of that, each of these genes, and people either have a gene mutation in one copy of BRCA1 or one copy of BRCA2, typically. They both are linked with a higher chance of breast cancer in someone's lifetime, and the early studies had very high risks of estimated lifetime risks, up as high as 85. Some of the newer studies that are collected have found it's a little bit lower, but it's still a significant increase from a 12% lifetime chance of breast cancer that we generally see in the United States. There is an increased chance with both of these genes for increased chance of earlier onset of breast cancer. And there's an increased chance of a second separate breast cancer in someone's lifetime that's not related to the first breast cancer. And when people are making decisions about what to do if they have about the risk of a second breast cancer, it's really important to look at what age they are at the time that they're first diagnosed, not just look at what the overall lifetime chance of a second breast cancer is. What I mean by that is if I'm age 60 at the time that I'm diagnosed with my first breast cancer and I have a BRCA1 mutation, my chance of getting a second separate breast cancer is much lower than someone who has their first diagnosis at age 30 of a breast cancer. The reason is I've kind of lived through some of that risk and not gotten a breast cancer. And so I might make different decisions than someone who's younger who has a new diagnosis of breast cancer. So it's really helpful when people are making decisions, like if I have a breast cancer and am I going to do bilateral mastectomies because of the risk of a second breast cancer, I might want to look at exactly what age I am and what my residual risk chance of a second breast cancer is. Ovarian cancer is linked with both of these genes, fallopian tube and peritoneal cancers as well. In fact, there's been a lot of new information about ovarian cancer and that most of them actually started out as fallopian tube cancers that then went to the ovary and developed. And BRCA, BRCA1 mutation, people who carry those have about a twice as high a chance of ovarian cancer as BRCA2. So it is important for people to know that information and they're making decisions about what to do. And both of them are significantly higher than the chance of about 1% that women typically have for ovarian cancer in their lifetime. BRCA2 has some other cancers that are linked with it, and one of them is male breast cancer. BRCA1 has about a 1% chance of male breast cancer instead of about 1 in 1,000 for the average population. So there's a slight increase of BRCA1, but it's really about a 6 or 7% lifetime chance for male breast cancer for men who carry a mutation in BRCA2. And some of the really new information in the last 3 or 4 years is the link with prostate cancer and BRCA2. It is about a 20% lifetime chance of prostate cancer, and they can tend to be a little younger and more aggressive. And so that's why one of the guidelines is aggressive or metastatic prostate cancers. Pancreatic cancer is linked with BRCA2, and the lifetime chance is probably between 2 and 7% instead of a half of a percent lifetime chance for people in the general population. And melanoma is also slightly increased with BRCA2, probably about 2 to 4% of people with a BRCA2 mutation can get a melanoma instead of 1%. So that's important because there are risks for men and women of some of these cancers linked with these genes. And people who have Jewish ancestry, Eastern European Jewish ancestry, which is called Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, have a much higher chance of carrying a BRCA1 or 2 gene mutation. It's the chance is 1 in 40 instead of 1 in 400 or 1 in 500 in the general population. And it's really specifically because of these three mistakes or mutations in BRCA1 and 2 that people who have that ancestry are much more likely to carry because of their ancestry. This is, I don't mean for you guys to read this, but it's important to know that the guidelines for how people, what are options for people who carry gene mutations and medical choices, get updated sometimes multiple times a year. And the NCCN are guidelines that people in oncology follow, and it's comes out of the comprehensive network out of the National Cancer Institute. They get panels of experts that adjust these guidelines with new information. And they have very precise information about treating someone with BRCA1 mutation differently than BRCA2, for example. And it's important for people to understand those differences. Basically, some of the most important part about BRCA1 and 2 is to give the option of different screening for people. Annual breast MRIs start at age 25 for women who carry BRCA1 or 2 gene mutations, and annual mammograms and MRIs starting at 30. So the MRIs start 5 years before adding a mammogram. And that's screen surveillance that should be offered to people who carry these gene mutations. They also, the way they word the guidelines is people can discuss the option of risk reduction mastectomy to reduce the risk of cancer before someone gets it. And that's an option people have. The wording is also, we don't have good surveillance or screening for ovarian cancer yet. So the wording of these guidelines are to discuss mastectomy, but recommend removal of the ovaries and fallopian tubes when people are done having their kids, and by 35 to 40 at age for BRCA1 and 40 to 45 with BRCA2. And if people do this prior to menopause and have not had a cancer, they can often take some hormone replacement so they aren't put into menopause. And it is known that this reduction of removal of ovaries does reduce the risk of breast cancer for women as well. So these are the kind of strategies that people can use to detect cancers early or prevent them. So now when I titled this More Than BRCA, I think it's important for people to know genetic testing is changing. There's this new technology called next generation sequencing that allows labs to build tests by putting dozens to hundreds to even thousands of genes on one test. So they're multi-gene tests. We also call them gene panels. And in the field of cancer, they can build these to be towards one group of cancers, like a colon cancer focused one or a breast and ovarian cancer focused one. There are also some very specialized panels, like a kidney cancer panel or these other rarer ones. And the costs have come down to $1,000 or $2,000 if it's billed through insurance, and some labs have self-pay options, which are several hundred dollars. There are benefits to these tests, and there are real drawbacks to them, and I'm going to talk about it. But the other way that genetic testing is changing is the use of these genetic test results, either on the tumor or on blood or a saliva sample, are now really guiding chemotherapy decisions. And there are a lot of clinical trials now that are focused on people's genetic background and offering them different chemotherapy options. For example, in those NCCN guidelines, they talk about the use of PARP inhibitors for ovarian cancer and HER2-negative breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer is a big change, and also the use of platinum therapy for prostate cancers when BRCA one or two, and sometimes some of the other genes as well are part of these trials. So a gene panel test, if we think we have 20,000 genes, they essentially look at the genes like sentences in a big book. We're going to include these because they're the genes that we're looking for linked with a certain disease. And for breast cancer, we focus on BRCA 1 and 2. And for a long time, that next line, TP53, P10, CDH1, those are linked with very distinct inherited conditions that have other findings and other cancers linked with them. And they're fairly rare, but if they're present, it's important to know about them. And then the third one, I'm going to be talking about these a little bit more, there are moderate breast cancer risk genes, and those common ones are ATM and CHEK2 and PALB2. And then the next one shows some other genes that are being all included in hereditary breast cancer and hereditary cancer panels. And so this kind of panel testing is getting at more of what that 5 to 10% of hereditary breast cancer is caused by. And it's important for people to know that they need, if this is present in their family, they need to be followed for that specific gene mutation, that gene and not others, because these genes have different risks linked with them. So let's go back to some basic genetic testing information. If someone does genetic testing, typically it involves blood and saliva or saliva, and more people are using just saliva samples like they do for the ancestry testing. You spit in a tube and send it in and it gets tested. If possible, if you're looking at a family history where you're wondering if there's something hereditary going on for cancer, it's best to start with the person who's had the cancer that you suspect of being hereditary. For example, if there are two women with breast cancer in a family and one had it at 80 and one had it at 40, we would start with the person who was age 40 because it's more likely their cancer is a hereditary cause. It's more likely we're going to have an answer by testing that person. Often, we don't get to do that. Someone has passed away. I can't have my relatives get tested, and if I don't have cancer, I want to pursue testing. You can do that, but and the closer there are strategies that are best for finding that. If I don't have cancer and no one in the family has been tested, and I get tested, if I find a gene mutation, well, that's helpful, and we know something. But a lot of times we get back a normal test result and we don't know what that means. It would mean something different if we knew my mom carried it and I don't, compared to if I don't have a gene mutation and we don't even know if that's the genes I got tested for are one of the genes that's responsible for my family history. So there's a good chance that we didn't test the right cause because we may not even know it yet. So people need to be careful when we're testing someone who doesn't have cancer and no one has been tested in the family. It's harder to make a conclusion if you don't find something. It's important to order the appropriate testing from a quality lab that does clinical testing and has to meet standards for clinical quality. And testing is getting more complicated, so it's really important for people to know that they're getting, like if my mother had a mutation in a gene, I need to know that I'm actually getting tested in a way that we will look at that specific part of the gene and know whether I carry it or not. And interpreting results is really important as well. This is a slide that's a little busy, but I think it's important to know that when you get a genetic test back, there are categories of the way they categorize the results. A pathogenic mutation or a pathogenic variant is the same as a mutation, the way I've been talking about today. It's a new phrase that they are now using. And if something's pathogenic or it's very likely pathogenic, the lab will classify it that way. Some labs will call it a positive result. Positive means they found something, even though it may not be information people consider it's positive for them, but it's a result that you can act on and follow someone differently for and guide their care. The more genes you look at, the more you're going to find something called a variant of uncertain significance. And a variant of uncertain significance means they found a change in a gene and they don't know if it's significant. They don't know if it's linked with cancer risk at all. It's unclear. And it's really important for people to not be followed like it's a real mutation if they carry that. But they can be followed based on their family history. And sometimes people will get increased screening even though a change hasn't been found because we don't understand. So the benefit of these multi-gene panels is that we can find more causes of inherited cancer, and there will be rapid development of knowledge as people have had more increased testing and we know more. The drawbacks are that some of these genes that are on these tests, we don't have any clear guidelines about how people ought to be treated differently if they carry a gene mutation. There are not management guidelines. So I might find out I have a mutation in a gene, but they aren't even clear about what the exact cancers linked with that gene are. And that can be really frustrating to have this information that's not complete. And the more genes that are on a test, the drawback is there's a much higher rate that someone's going to get a variant of uncertain significance. And it's really important that they and their doctors not treat it like it is a deleterious or pathogenic mutation. So when we look at these genes, and I've kind of gone through them, some of them are linked with very high rates of breast cancer, overlapping with high rates like BRCA1 and 2, but some of them have moderate or, 20 or 30% lifetime risk of breast cancer instead of 50%. And some have just ovarian cancer risk, some have just breast cancer risk. Also, within the genes, like CHEK2, there is a specific mutation that has a much lower cancer risk than others. And so the lab report will state if this is a mistake in a gene that has a lower risk than just thinking of the whole gene itself. So it's really important to customize the counseling. In these hereditary breast ovarian cancer genes, I have on the right side near the bottom the Lynch syndrome genes. And Lynch syndrome is the most common inherited cause of colon cancer. And it has uterine cancer risk with it as well, but it also has ovarian cancer risk with it. And 1 in 300 people who have colon cancer have Lynch syndrome, and it's most people have never heard of this condition, and it really can guide very different colon screening for people if they carry this condition. And I don't mean for you to read this fine print, but I want you to know that the NCCN is really trying to collect information on these specific new genes as they come out and when we have enough information about them to guide care in different ways. And these key ones, like for example, ATM here, they talk about whether people would qualify for increased breast surveillance, whether they recommend that they be offered preventative mastectomies, and whether they recommend the ovarian prevention surgery. And it's really important that people get counseling by what we know on these genes and the specific condition they have. If a family has a significant family history of breast cancer and testing is done and there is no cause found, then there are guidelines for increased breast screening based on family history. And for example, the NCCN guidelines, we have models we can use looking at family history to estimate if someone has over a 20% lifetime chance of getting breast cancer in their lifetime. And if they do, they qualify for increased screening with mammograms and MRIs. And this is, a lot of people aren't aware that there are these different increased screening even when a genetic cause hasn't been found.
So Barb, we have a couple questions. So
yep.
Not sure if this is the appropriate time, but I think it probably is.
No, it's good.
One is, when should my daughter start being checked if I was diagnosed at 37? What should we do to be proactive?
Well, it's a great time to ask it with this slide up. So if I had breast cancer at 37 and my daughter wanted to know if she qualified for increased breast surveillance, not just a mammogram, but an MRI that can see changes in the breast younger, and if she had an increased risk at a younger age, this is a good tool. We could look at whether she qualified with that increased 20% lifetime chance. And the way that's calculated is there are different models. And if I look at, let's say, one of the models is called a Klaus model. And if I'm her daughter and I have one first degree relative, my mom, who is diagnosed 30 to 39, and that's all my family history is, then the lifetime estimate of risk is about 16.5%. So that doesn't quite make it, but if there's any other family history, it can easily get above that. And there are some other models that a genetic counselor or someone who does this kind of risk assessment can use to see what the models show. And so it's hard to answer it exactly in this situation because that alone doesn't make her qualify for this increased breast surveillance with breast MRI, but she easily could if there's more family history. And the key question, though, with that one is, number one, the mom qualifies for genetic testing. And if she had a genetic cause for her cancer, it may not have come down to her daughter. And so then her daughter wouldn't need genetic increased surveillance if we knew why her mom had her breast cancer and we knew the daughter didn't inherit it. But so the first thing is the mom could be offered testing. And then if the mom did not carry a gene mutation, her daughter could use the family history to guide the care. Anything else you want to ask Anne right now?
Yes, we got another question that is along these lines, but it's about retesting. So this person asked, I had genetic testing done after my breast cancer diagnosis 11 years ago. I was BRCA 1 and 2 negative. Given the advancements in genetic testing for other health diseases, should I be retested?
And the answer is probably yes. BRCA 1 and 2 are only part of it. And I'll give an example of a study. So if someone met the criteria for BRCA 1 and 2 testing, number one, BRCA 1 and 2 testing actually changed early on. They missed some of the big changes in the genes that are called rearrangement. So the first version of the BRCA 1 and 2 testing didn't even look at those two genes as well as it needed to. And so there was a point at which they added a test called BART, because this was all done at Myriad Genetics. They did the only BRCA1 and 2 testing initially. So there was a study that looked at the women who had qualified for BRCA1 and 2 testing and then went back and tested them. And this was a 2015 study. And they found that they used a 21-gene panel that looked at genes linked with breast and ovarian cancer. And they found that about 7% of the women who had the BRCA testing initially and then went back and got tested, 7% of them had a mutation in one of the other genes other than BRCA1 and 2. And that's a high enough yield for a test, especially when it might guide care for a person and their family, that it's worth going back, especially when it was that long ago. The big question is, if I get tested, how often should I go back and get tested? And every year or two, they're only, you know, adding maybe a gene or another gene. So it's hard to know when to jump back in and get tested. But it's something that no one really has a clear answer for. But that setting of someone who got tested that long ago, it's really appropriate to revisit it.
Thank you.
Anything else, Anne?
Not at this time.
And I talked about how the guidelines for testing are really changing. This year we had a surprising recommendation out of the Association of Breast Surgeons, and it's very detailed, but I think the second one is very interesting. The third one actually also pertains to that question you just had. The first one is that people who, breast surgeons, genetic counselors, other medical professionals knowledgeable about genetic testing can provide education, counseling, and recommendations. So people are getting counseling and testing from people other than genetic counselors, and the breast surgeons are essentially saying, we have a lot of expertise in this too, and we can do this. And the second is that they feel that breast genetic testing should be available to all women who've had a personal history of breast cancer. This is a bit controversial right now. Number one, we don't know if insurance will cover it because it certainly isn't the guidelines. But I think they're pointing out that more and more genetic testing is going to be guiding medical care and even treatment decisions, and that that information needs to be available to families because we know personal and family history aren't perfect for detecting all of the hereditary causes. So it may be the trend that we're going to. I've often thought that in the next 10 years, it may be that everybody who has a cancer gets tested on a genetic level in some way. But we certainly aren't ready for that yet. And we don't, and I'm not saying about this, I think that there are many women who don't quite meet criteria that may want to pursue genetic testing. I think we're going to see more and more of that. And that's why they're bringing it up. And the third, this is a longer thing. I'm just have a snippet, but patients who had genetic testing previously may benefit from updating testing. And they're bringing that up this year as the breast surgeons. So I want to talk a little about some other genetic testing or options that people may have heard of or want to know about. And the first one is DNA banking. A lot of people don't know that you can store someone's DNA privately so that later that person's family can use it to do future testing. And it can be done privately. I included a link that's called Prevention Genetics is a lab in Wisconsin. That's probably the best DNA banking option for people. It costs about $170 to store someone's DNA, and they say for 50 years. And we're going to know a lot more in the next coming decades about causes of cancer that are hereditary. And it may be valuable to have a sample of someone's DNA for their relatives to understand why they had a cancer. For example, my mom had breast cancer, and we don't know why she had her breast cancer. And before she passed away, I did have her DNA stored so that if at any point I or my sisters or my descendants want to know about whether her cancer was linked with a gene that we then will know about, we will have that sample as an option. Also, there is a trend, and it's an interesting trend, but it's really not being actively used yet. If you look at that little pie diagram, there's another 15 or 20% of breast cancers that occur for, you see a cluster of them, like two sisters with breast cancer, and you don't know the hereditary cause. And there may be more complex combinations of risks that are causing it, not a single gene. And some of the labs are starting to use something called a polygenic risk score. And some people who go through genetic testing may actually see them on the report. And the idea is that most of these risk isn't a single gene. It's all these tiny, tiny risks that add up. And so what the lab does is they're not looking at changes that actually cause the risk. They're looking across your entire genome of 20,000 genes at markers that are spaced throughout that whole genome. And they're statistically looking for ones that have a small increased risk. And then they combine them all to try and get a sense of who might have an increased risk and who might not, that the genetic testing isn't identifying. And the problem with it right now is it's not clear if I got an increased polygenic risk score for breast cancer. It's not clear. The guidelines aren't including yet that, yes, that I ought to be offered increased breast screening with earlier mammograms or earlier MRIs. But it's clear, people need to know that these scores, that they're looking at changes that aren't the cause themselves, but it's literally hundreds of markers that if I have enough of them, those risks might stack up to make my risk very different than my neighbor's. So that's coming. And the other is, people have asked, a lot of people for treatment are being offered genetic testing that is looking at the tumor themselves. For example, Foundation One looks at 324 genes in the tumor. And one of the things that
is important to know is that you can find inherited risk in there. So take, for example, this woman, and she has, let's say, a colon cancer, and they tested her tumor, and one of the genes they look at for predicting treatment choices is BRCA2, and they find that change there. Well, we don't know if that's part of the tumor's DNA or if it was there in all of her cells, and that she has a background inherited cause. So instead of looking at the tumor, the follow-up is to look to a blood or a saliva sample and see if that same mutation is there. And actually, the NCCN guidelines added this year that, last year, that anyone with a BRCA1 or 2 gene mutation on a tumor test should make sure that they have an evaluation to make sure it's not inherited. And they're saying even not just breast and ovarian tumors, any tumor that shows a BRCA2 variant. So that's the other trend, is people finding out genetic information. And medical practitioners may not be aware that of those guidelines, and so it's important for people to know that some of these changes they see in tumors may not be the tumor themselves. The other is to direct to consumer genetic testing, and 23andMe is really stepping into hereditary testing of other things, and it's important for people to know that the BRCA1 and 2 testing on 23andMe is very incomplete. In fact, there is an op-ed in the LA Times by a genetic counselor pointing out that how incomplete it is. It's just looking for the three mutations that are more common in people who have Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, not the thousands of ways that these two genes could be have mistakes in them. And so it's not looking thoroughly at BRCA1 and 2, and it's not looking at other genes that have that risk. And the other thing about testing through 23andMe, if you're going to use it clinically, it's really important that you get it verified in a lab that has more clinical standards for evaluating these genes. I think of it as a screen. So it's important to get confirmatory testing of any result you get from a direct-to-consumer genetic test. And one of the labs actually looked at people who came in to who'd had testing through direct-to-consumer testing, and they found that 40% of them that thought they had a mutation, a change, it wasn't. And so that shows how it's helpful information, but don't base your medical decisions on it. It's also important for people to know there are resources, and this is my final slide, and then we can go to questions. There are really good resources, like FORCE, facingatrisk.org is a really great organization related to breast and ovarian cancer and the hereditary piece, and they have lists of clinical trials. They have really good information on it. The National Cancer Institute does also. SHARE-IT is a focus on the Jewish piece of the increased risk of BRCA1 and 2 mutations, and they have really good information for families, and Be Bright Pink is another one. And I'm going to end there with my talk, and I look forward to hearing what questions people have, and thanks for attending this webinar today. I appreciate the chance to talk to you all.
Well, Barb, this has been really valuable information. It is generating some questions. There are two right off the top that I want to make sure that I've asked. Is, have there been studies done on the ATM gene mutation?
Okay. So ATM is one of these moderate breast cancer risk genes, and there continue to be more and more studies looking at them and trying to understand the exact risks linked with ATM. Right now, it is known that ATM is linked with an increased risk of breast cancer, and there appears to be an increased risk of pancreas cancer, and some increase in ovarian cancer possibly, but we don't know much about it. The breast cancer definitely, and so there are people, and because it's common enough, there are a lot of people trying to gather that information. And I guess the best advice I have is, yes, there's new information. I don't know if it's going to be relevant to the person asking on the call, but it's important to go back to, if you did have somebody who's a genetic professional, and have them look at that specific mutation and see if we know more about it. and they can go back to those NCCN guidelines for ATM and see if they've changed since that person was last seen to make sure they're getting the right surveillance. And I actually think we're going to learn a lot about ATM, Check 2, and PALB 2 in the next 5 years, because they're the ones that are common enough that we're seeing a lot of people who have them.
Okay, so one other one, I think that you followed this, but covered this already, but I think it probably bears repeating if you did. If I hear through my family grapevine that a relative carries a mutation in a breast cancer gene, what should I do, and can I get tested?
Okay, so the first thing is to, because there are so many genes and different mutations, is get a hold of the genetic test result. A genetic counselor or other professional coordinating testing for you needs to know what they're going to be testing for and to make sure they're testing for what's known in the family. And so if someone has told you about it, you should be able to try to get a hold of that test result. And people are given their test results, and oftentimes, or they can sign a consent that you can, a professional can get it from the testing lab. So you need to know what the gene is, what the exact address along that gene where that mistake is, to not be able to offer testing. Yes, if you have a mutation in your family, you should be offered testing. Some insurances will only cover it if it's a certain number of steps away. Like if it's 4 steps away from me, they won't cover it. But if it's on my mother's side and it's her cousin, well, my mother could get tested. She's 3 steps away. But testing's cheap enough that oftentimes people self-pay. It's only a couple hundred bucks to get tested. And some of the labs, if it's a newly identified mutation, they'll offer free testing for the mutation for close family members in order to improve the uptake in families. So that's kind of a new trend just from a few labs. So, yes, you could probably get testing. It'd probably be valuable for you. It's important. I guess one other thing I'll say is if you get tested because you have that relative, know that your result only tells you about you and your descendants, your kids. It won't tell you about your sister who might have gotten the mutation when you didn't. And so people can't make assumptions about their risk based on yours. Okay.
Excellent.
What else, Anne?
We have time for 2 more questions, I think, and both from participants on this webinar. Do you know that if a father was exposed to Agent Orange, does that put their children at risk?
Oh, that's a really complicated question. It's outside of the breast cancer risk alone. There have been some studies, and I hate to say it, but I haven't looked at that for a few years. And so I don't know about the precise cancer risk linked with Agent Orange exposure. So I don't think I'm going to be able to answer that. There are certainly risks linked with Agent Orange, more for the person themselves, but I can't answer that. I'm so sorry.
And then the last question would be, any concerns about the use of these tests in obtaining life insurance?
In obtaining what?
In obtaining life insurance.
Oh, that's really important, actually, and I'm sorry that I didn't include that. In the United States, we have protections by a federal law called the GINA law for health insurance coverage and people not being discriminated against based on their family history or genetic test result in they or their relatives, okay? So for health insurance, people cannot be denied or charged more for insurance based on those, just the genetic piece, okay? But that federal law does not protect about life insurance. It doesn't give that protection. And people can't lie about their family history when they're applying for life insurance. So if I do, like I have had patients who come to me with a family history and we think we might do genetic testing, but they don't have life insurance in place and they want to get it, it's probably more valuable to go get life insurance first. Because at that point, you don't know what your risk is. And then to pursue genetic testing after you get life insurance in place. And the
other interesting piece that I just learned is that some insurance, life insurance companies are starting to ask people if they did 23andMe testing. And that's interesting because people think about that, don't think about it very much, and they do that lightly. They just say, oh, we'll do a this genetic test, and it might keep them from getting life insurance. So I do have some concerns. They can't, genetic testing information can be used by life insurance to decide they won't cover someone who has a higher risk. They also look at people's personal and family histories, and they can use it. So sometimes it's not just the test result.
Well, we are at the end of our hour. Gracious thanks to our speaker, Barb Kunz, and for everyone for joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and be sure to join us on May 29th and October 5th for more learning. Thank you very much, everyone.
Bye.